Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Red Couch Theology Podcast. This week, we're going to be talking about Star Wars and birds, actually a little bit less about birds, and we're going to be talking about how hard it is to sometimes believe that God's going to take care of us, that we can trust that. So we're going to dive right in.
Hello.
Oh.
We're live. And we have a very serious podcast today. Today we're going to be talking about really serious things where I don't know how to do an intro like that.
Especially when we're both prepping for Easter and Holy Week. And
you have a blue glow today. You like that?
How do I have that? Very ethereal.
Yeah. There's right behind you off camera. There's a little glowy thing.
You just threw that in there. It looks like, if I can grab it in the right place, it looks like I've got a lightsaber, but
yeah. I was using this for an interview earlier this week and I decided to just keep it. You want the lightsaber? Oh, see if Alex falls out of his chair.
I am your father.
Oh, gosh.
Wait, no, he didn't have a blue lightsaber.
One of them did, didn't they?
No, I mean, Darth Vader didn't.
But who was it that had blue?
Luke. That was his father's lightsaber that he'd inherited. But then he had a green one later that he made himself.
Okay.
Because he lost the blue one in the Battle of Cloud City when his hand was chopped off and it dropped into the thing for all eternity.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I've only seen the movie, never read the books.
Star Wars is that there aren't any books. It's original source material. Oh my goodness. We are through the, like, whatever. How do you not know this about Star Wars?
Well, that's information that's in the movies?
Yeah.
It talks about him making a green lightsaber?
Darth Vader says to him in the third one, I see you have constructed another. Your training is complete. Or something like that.
Really?
Yeah. Dude, we are going to sit and watch. Okay, we're canceling the podcast. The new podcast will be me and Aaron sitting watching old movies together.
So
tell me.
There are books.
Written afterwards, retrospectively, yeah. That someone put together. Yeah. So, I mean, like, I'm just saying, it's not like.
I didn't know which one was first and which one was second or whatever.
Like, so you've got some movies, you have to read the books because they were written first. You can't just watch the Lord of the Rings movies. Ideally, you read the books first. Harry Potter, I mean. I'm starting to come around to the way of thinking that Harry Potter is a children's series that people hold on to way too long. So, you know, I'm kind of like, over that a little bit. But Narnia,
Now that you're over your 40s, you finally have let go of Harry Potter.
I never loved Harry Potter in the way I love Narnia. Like, I do see elements of Jesus in it, but I think with Narnia and Lord of the Rings, he just imbibes it all.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know... So I'm always with people like, oh, please say you're going to go read the books, even if you've already watched the movies. But with Star Wars, I'm like, yeah, if you want to. I don't think it really matters. If someone just sat with the movie and just went like this. So you're not really getting much different.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I tried to start serious, and somehow we ended up on Star Wars.
You
have a gift, my friend.
He's one of the great stories, but not the greatest story
ever told.
Ever told, which we might be talking about on Resurrection Sunday
next week. Ah, I see what you did there. he's the master of segueing off script and back on. All right, well, hello everyone. It's so good to see you all out there. We don't see you. I'm lying. But we assume that you're out there watching the show. And today we're talking about
worry.
Drum roll. The Sermon on the Mount.
Yes.
Which
I don't know how many week.
But this is the last week of season two.
Uh-huh.
Or part two.
Part two.
Of the Sermon on the Mount. And then we're going to go.
Chapter six.
Last season week chapter three six. Will be in the summer.
Yep. Yeah. So it'll start either the start of June or sometime in July.
Yeah.
And so then we will get back to some, I mean, there's some great, but there's a chapter seven is definitely shorter. So it's maybe 6 weeks in chapter seven. Whereas this is our 11th week, I think. No, ninth week in chapter six. And we spent 11 weeks in chapter five.
Yeah.
So,
right off the bat, we have a few questions. I'm doing air quotes. questions that came in.
More commentary.
More commentary. But I feel like it's an appropriate call out because you may have seen this in Alex's sermon on Sunday. So one of you said, did you get it from this? You had to have, right?
I
Oh, this is all right. So let me describe. This different. Is Maslow's hierarchy of needs with the Wi-Fi at the very base thing. Like before food, shelter, water is Wi-Fi. So thank you all.
Which was very apt given there was no Wi-Fi in the church when you preached that sermon.
Which is
and there was no.
Which is where this came from. Yeah, but then you jumped in on it and used this image on Sunday, which is fun.
I did. I actually found a different image, but it was pretty similar.
Yeah.
Mine was red. And I think I'd seen it before, but I think I must have seen. I think I couldn't remember where I'd seen it. It was the problem.
So there you go. We answered that question. Thank you for sending that. That was hysterical, especially given the fact that I preached without Wi-Fi that week prior. I don't know how I missed it last week. And then this is a question comment thing that I'm not sure I quite understood. But Pavlov's dog asks, have we been conditioned to salivate for money?
Ooh,
and there's an article about this.
Huh.
And so I'm not going to read the article right now.
Well, I briefly mentioned Pavlov's dog, like, was it a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
And that, it seems very pertinent for us in terms of how we react to food, but potentially also for money as well. I could totally see that. I mean, I think there's something attractive to us about the possibility that we might gain wealth. Like if you start thinking about a lottery win or something, most people can go a decent chunk of time imagining what they would do with surprisingly perpetual wealth.
Yeah.
So, I think that person's probably onto something. I think what exactly it is that's, I think my question about whether it's similar to Pavlov's dog, I think there is a similarity with possessions and advertising in Pavlov's dog.
Yeah.
I don't know whether there's enough. I don't think actually there's enough people out there that genuinely want you to be rich, that they're sending messages saying, get rich, get rich, get rich, get rich. But stuff, I think that's definitely true. And there's a whole bunch of science into like how sex has worked within advertising. It's supposed to show enough of different body images, but not everything, to give you a sense of like, oh, there's more to get out of that. There's the way that advertising works around like the latest tennis shoes and another, the one I loved not long ago was, did I don't know if they did it over here, because this was in England, there was a beer brand called Dos Equis that did the whole, like, the most interesting man in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Was that over here?
Yeah.
And it was like, it was always like, you know, he is the most popular person at every party, and it go through all these different things. And actually somewhere the message it gave you was, if you drink Dos Equis, you'll be like the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah.
Which is nonsense. And it's the same message that says like,
that's nonsense.
Yeah, sorry.
Does anyone want to buy some Dos Equis? No, I'm just joking. I've never actually tried it.
You've got a garage full of it. Yeah, I've been drinking this and nothing but this.
I've been less and less interesting every day.
No. And it's the same message that, you know, that really probably, I mean, Air Jordans are probably the first effort at it, or the most notable effort at it. Like, it's the first time an athlete is so distinctly attached to a brand of shoe that you're like, oh my goodness, if I wear Jordans, I might start playing basketball like Jordan.
I saw an interview, a late night interview with Michael Jordan, where he's like unveiling his Air Jordans, and they made fun of them on the show.
That's incredible, isn't it?
And then he was like, yeah, oh, this isn't the final design. It was like very awkward.
Uh-huh. Oh man.
Very awkward.
But now look at them.
Now they're like, probably, that first series is probably worth millions of dollars.
Well, they are. Actually, a couple of my friends had the first Air Jordans. I was right in that age range, and if they kept a man, I bet they're worth tons. So I think we're that's what we're implicitly trained to do. We're like, oh yeah, that will give me that. That will give me that. That will give me that.
Yeah, and again, back to the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, is because we're wired to try and provide for these various different basic needs. Mm-hmm. And then advertisers just basically promise that if you buy my product, then XYZ need will be met.
Yeah.
Whether it's self-actualization or safety or fame or reputation or whatever, all of those different desires that we have as human beings are on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Advertiser just has to define which one are we going to pretend like this thing's going to help.
But it's not as simple as that, is it? Because, I mean, Maslow's now a little bit outdated. I mean, he was the 70s, so like a lot's happened since then. So I think he's right to a degree that there are natural needs that are present there. But then there's also a creation of needs that aren't real needs that are outside of his perspective a little bit, I think.
I don't know, because if you look at the list, we're going to pull up our cheeky version since that's the one I have quickly accessible. But like, I think it covers all of the actual needs. So you have physical needs, that's survival. Then you have safety and security. Then you have social needs.
Uh-huh.
What product doesn't try and engage one of these things?
Well, it does, but it also fakes what fills the need. So it like you can actually never buy a product from anybody and fulfill all of the needs on there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what I'm saying
is that they claim if you buy our product, you're going to fulfill XYZ need, which then draws on a deeper, almost the like the lizard brain, the back part of your brain that like is saying safety, security, self-actualization, all the stuff that we're like wired as physiologically even to think like, that's what they're trying to tap into.
Yeah. So it plays on a dissatisfaction of where you actually are on that hierarchy.
Yeah. And so the lie is whether that product could actually meet that need.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some products that that have some ability to meet that need. But they're all trying to appeal to that baser instinct within within yourself to try and meet these needs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just lying to you most of the time
that thing is Were you a
possible.
Fan of the TV show Mad Men?
I never watched it.
Okay. So it's like it's basically the Madison Avenue guys of I think it starts in the '50s maybe. But like just how they go about selling and stuff. And it's just intriguing to watch. Like there's just so much to it. And really like you could argue that I think Shane Hipps, the author once said before he became a pastor, he said, I still sold salvation. I just sold it for $150,000 and it came in the form of a Porsche. Like, so, I mean, just like there's an awareness that that's actually what you're doing for people. Or like pretending you're doing, you're like, oh, this will give you everything that you want.
Yeah. So I think back to the passage, both between 2 weeks ago and last Sunday where you preached, this whole section is not anti-meeting needs.
Mm-hmm.
It's just offering a different means to meet those needs, which is the king in the kingdom
and
all these sorts of things. Yeah.
And that somewhere, though these needs remain true as a human being, there's an element to the kingdom that can lead you to a point where if you don't get all of those things, you can actually say, okay, I'm okay with that. This kingdom is different to that.
But I think the kingdom offers 100% of them every time.
I think it...
Maybe not in this life.
We should get to that. I don't know if I agree.
Maybe not in this life.
That's the thing, right? Like, yeah.
But see, I don't... Again, and maybe this is just how I'm wired. Okay, so if this life is a hot mess, I just feel like,
yeah, I think we're saying the same thing.
But the kingdom, the eternal kingdom, will offer every one of these needs
absolutely.
In spades.
Oh, agreed, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it allows you to, in this life experience, a leveling of the hierarchy, a complete failure of the hierarchy, and still say, I'm okay.
Yeah. Yeah, which is why Paul can say, you know, I've learned to have plenty. I've learned
plenty
to have little,
content.
All of this stuff.
Paul can be sounds so smug at times. I don't think he means to. And I'm not saying he is, but
I think he's telling the truth. He's just like.
No, he is. No, but he's like, he sounds so good. Do you not ever get that from him? I'm like I've learned to be content with nothing. I'm like, okay, some of us haven't learned that yet.
Fair enough.
Some of us still want our Air Jordans, and we're working on it, okay? Some of us, the salvation of Jesus hasn't permeated every single area of our lives yet.
What? I thought that that was it.
I think that's what I wrestle with when I'm reading it. I'm like, oh my goodness, you really have allowed this thing to get to every single level.
But I actually think that that's a rabbinic thing.
Okay, so it's using like a rhetorical.
I don't know if it's rhetorical. I just think it's like I was actually just listening to a podcast by a rabbi.
Uh-huh.
And the guy does sound like a know-it-all, but that's because the podcast is, it's in rabbinic style. The other co-hosts are his disciples.
Okay.
And so he's constantly asking, like, what do you see here?
Uh-huh.
And asking him to fill in the blank, like they're almost like an elementary school class. Uh-huh. And he knows everything about the subject. Uh-huh. And so I think, and I could, yeah, obviously I'm projecting a modern rabbinic style back on it, but I think maybe if you're the rabbi, you're supposed to be, quote unquote, put together enough where you're able to say stuff like, Paul, follow me as I follow Christ. Uh-huh. Like, I'm figuring it out, but if you can be more like me, then it's a win all around. Like, that's the rabbinic thing.
I think that is true. I think that the implication can be, I figured it out, not I'm figuring it out.
I know.
Present tense. I think it's a past participle.
But I think that's maybe one of the hazards of the job.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah. I have a crowd full of people who are literally trying to mimic my every physical uh-huh. movement.
Yeah.
And maybe I do know everything. You know, it might be one of the psychological hazards of the job.
Yeah.
So sometimes he comes off as like...
strangely similar to being a Baptist pastor in certain parts of the South in the 80s. It's
like, yeah.
You are the perfect human being.
Yeah.
I do think that you're right. There's always that facade or the what you see of someone in a position like that. And I think South is a church that has kind of tried to allow a little bit more visibility into the humanity of people that are involved in leading it.
One of them.
Yeah. And there's other churches that are like that. And I'm glad for that.
Well, that level of incompetence is running this whole thing.
I remember Paul Tripp said, like, he was talking in one of his books on marriage about some of the crisis he and his wife were going through. And he said in the middle of an argument, he turned around to her and went, you know, 95% of the women in the church would love to be married by a man like me, to a man like me. And his wife turned around and said, yeah, I'm one of the 5%. She saw him as he really was.
Yeah.
So I think, I think you're probably right. There is a, it must get in your head a little bit to have so many people listening to every word that you say and copying everything that you do.
Yeah. I don't know.
Anyway.
So on this, back to the subject of Sunday.
We say anyway a lot on this book. Anyway, getting back.
Anyway, we should probably talk about the subject for the day. And if you're still out there listening, I apologize. I mean, I get all this feedback of like, no, we love the intro banter. You guys could just cut to the chase. And then, no, we love the intro banter. And now we're like torn. We don't know what to do. So,
but we're just going to put hashtag Star Wars at the beginning. And hopefully we kept a few of the Star Wars nerds.
That's right. So tell me, how did it feel to like to preach this passage after being laid out the promise that people promises.
So it was challenging. One, I don't think I did a very good job of it. And two, I'd already done a chunk of like my structure. So I was like, okay, how much am I willing to just throw away everything that I've got like prepared just to appease Aaron's desire to not do all the work he was supposed to do? So I think I liked that we tried to hold the tension that all of this passage is correlated. All the sermon is correlated. Chapter 6 is correlated. Like they're all, they run on from each other. And even the opening of my passage, therefore, gave this like heavy point back towards, you know, based on what you've just learned,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of the thing that came before, then this is how I want you to live. So I actually love when you get to do that as a community, to recognize the way that things flow on.
It all ties together.
Yeah.
So then let me ask this. I noticed you spent very little time on the illustrations that he has in the text, birds and flowers. You reference them in passing a couple times. So what was your... I think that that's maybe where most preachers go.
I think they probably do.
They probably linger there for ages.
Yeah.
And you mentioned them in passing almost in a like... Yeah, this isn't a great illustration way. So to unpack your reasoning for why you wanted to go into the second movement, or like actually you went backwards and then you went to the end.
Yeah,
more.
Yeah. So I think I really wanted us to land on the fact that verse 33 seems to be the defining aspect to the whole of the chapter, and perhaps the central part of the whole of the sermon. Now there's other
That's
verses.
That's the seek first
yeah,
the kingdom of God.
There's other verses
and his
you could pitch. You know, you talked about the start of the Lord's Prayer as being the two greatest verses ever written, and they are. But these two are tied deeply, right? Like there's the God let your kingdom come and let your will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Yeah.
Deeply tied to, and I'm as my small part of that. I'm going to seek first that kingdom. In my own life.
Yeah.
So it's this beautiful picture of what the church is when it's made up of millions of individuals whose main goal is to be formed in the way of Jesus. If we're genuinely saying, I'm going to seek first my kingdom, well, then of course we think about giving as a natural element of that because we're no longer driven by possessions and we can hold loosely the things we have and we can share them with those in need. Of course we think about prayer as being this relational connection point with our Father. Of course, we think about fasting as something that drives change in an invisible world, even if it costs us something in this material world.
Yeah.
So it feels like if we were going to land well, then that's where we needed to land. Like, I'm going to seek first the kingdom and trust everything else under this like broad scope of like, yeah, we don't need to worry about this life. And I think Jesus models that. I wanted to get to how Jesus modeled that on Palm Sunday with it being Palm Sunday. So I think the illustrations, I think they probably worked perfectly in Jesus' day. I think the danger of them sounds like I'm what the one, and anytime you're preaching, you are kind of, you feel at times like, am I just judging scripture and valuing certain bits over others? Because even just selecting some texts and not others makes that assumption. Like,
yeah. Totally.
And any preacher that says he's doing differently, like, well, yeah, tell me why you spend far more time in John's gospel than you do in like Haggai chapter, whatever.
Yeah.
So we all make some of those judgments.
You imagine a pastor who's like literally divides it up and like marks percentages and then actually preaches that way.
We all intrinsically know that John 3:16 has more to say to a community than Matthew 21:17. So to me, those illustrations, they in the first century world sum up his opening statement, like, do not worry about this life, which I wanted to focus on.
Yeah.
And he gives these couple of examples that can sound almost like a hippie moment to us in the 21st century. It's like, you know, man, have you seen the birds in the air? Like, they're just free. You ever thought about the flowers?
Just
like, they're just free. They're just flowers. They're just doing their thing. And it's really hard for us in our world of mortgages that have to be paid. In our world of car loans that we at least feel like they have to be paid. In our world of like credit card debt, to take that and say, I know what to do with that.
Yeah.
Like, because I think our natural reaction is, oh yeah, it must be nice, but also like, I have to have a house. And in the 21st century, it's pretty hard to own a house without a mortgage.
Yeah. I got up this morning at 4 a.m. and I went out and got bird seed.
Yeah.
And it's still not helping the mortgage situation.
Yeah. It totally hasn't.
I found 7 worms and my mortgage is not paid.
Yeah. So I think we intrinsically know that we now live in a world and again, not valuing it as good or bad. 100 years ago, the average person spent 95% of their income on food. 120 years ago. Like, and that was pretty consistent for a lot of human history. Unless you were very rich, you didn't spend a lot of money on housing. And people lived in shacks, they lived in hovels. And you still see that in parts of the world. Like you go different places and you still see that. They're building out of natural materials with their own hands. And we might even say, oh man, like there's something beautiful and simpler about that. But we also recognize it's really hard to make any decision that just opts us out of that system.
Yeah.
Like, what do I do with my family now? We have 25 years left to pay on our mortgage. Like, to opt out of that and still keep doing what we're doing, even just me doing this job, like, somewhere, like, what do you do? So I think those examples, they're accurate, they're right. Jesus gave them to us, the stuff to draw from them. But in this case, what I didn't want people to get overly obsessed with was trying to think, how can I be like a bird? And how can I be like a flower? Because I don't think that's Jesus' major thesis in the text. I actually think it's that thing that you and I just touched on. His major thesis is, and even if we become like a flower that's gone tomorrow, it's okay. Like, seeking the kingdom is still the thing that I'm called to do. And even if I'm a bird that doesn't get the seed, as many birds don't, then I'm still okay because I seek first the kingdom, and this kingdom is bigger than that thing.
Interesting.
So that's kind of where I wanted people to get to, instead of being like, yeah, just if only I could think like a flower, life would be good. Because I think that can be almost the implicit takeaway, even though I don't think it's, as I say, it's Jesus's point.
Ah, interesting.
Huh. So it felt like I wanted to reference it, but I wanted the weight of time to land on the first verse and the last verse, the therefore. And I really felt like I loved your sermon. I really felt like it would be helpful to people to pull Peter into that as an illustration, like on the ground in scripture.
Yeah.
Which then we'll also come back to on Easter Sunday, which will be fun. But just that idea of what it is to model seeking first the kingdom over those other things.
Yeah.
Felt like, oh man, this could be a really valuable setup to where we're going.
Yeah. So you jumped out of this particular text into that, a story of Peter. And again, what you just said to illustrate, because he has, if you weren't there, it's the story of Peter's essentially first significant encounter with Jesus. Mm-hmm. Fisherman, Jesus tells him to, this mountain man tells him how to fish. And he's like a professional fisherman.
So brilliant.
It's like a
guy who's never seen a building coming down and say, hey, build it like this.
Yeah, you should definitely build it this way.
There's so many extrapolations.
Yeah, and so it's kind of this comical moment, but then they catch what you referred to as like the equivalent of the lottery.
Well, and there's so many nerd factors to this. A book I'm meant to recommend if you like this kind of thing is Kenneth Bailey's Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. Yeah. Like, he does a deep dive on this whole passage that was really helpful to me. And so he talks about how, like, this is how much knowledge this guy has, because he's lived there and he's been in it. Like, he talks about fish, like their daily migratory patterns in the Sea of Galilee, and how they're on the surface during the night because it's cooler, and they're down in the deeps. So you can't net fish in the day.
Yeah, like, you hinted at a few things, and I was like, oh, it sounds like you did some reading this
week. Yeah. So there's basically there are no fish to catch with a net in the daytime. You can catch fish with a line in the daytime, but to go out and do that net fishing, and then there's times at night where if you get to the right place, usually I think they say it's usually in specific spots, and you can throw a spear in, and you can't not hit a fish. I mean, they're so tightly packed. So you just throw in a net and it just pulls them out by the netful. Now, the only way that changes in the day is if they happen to have hit a spring coming up from underground. And the fish will gather around the spring coming upward because it pushes cold water up from, like, underneath. And the fish will, like, follow it to the surface. And so there's occasional stories of people finding a new spring that's kind of jumped up out of somewhere, and the fish gather around it. So if you found that could be, if you were the only one that knew about it, it could be just this perpetual source of wealth. You just kept going back to it when nobody else was fishing, and you kept dragging in fish And you know, so it's like that lottery idea of getting the annuity that just pays out every year, and you never have to think about anything ever again.
Yeah. So that's like sort of what happens is this.
So that's
incredible catch of fish.
That would be Peter's natural assumption outside of Jesus just magicking the fish there.
Yeah.
The natural outworking would be, oh, Jesus has found like a spring bed, in the lake, sorry, a spring in the lake bed. And he's now like, this is the spot. We can keep going back to this spot. Jesus has made him rich and he's made us rich.
Oh, fascinating. See, yeah. Like you implied that, but I didn't know the reasoning behind
why that was. And it just like eventually, like how much time can I spend to this? Like if I'm Kenneth Bailey and I've got like 50 pages or a 2-hour lecture, like fine. But
I mean, the idea came across. Yeah. I just didn't have the evidence necessarily. Yeah, so, and then the illustration of this story is an illustration of seeking first the kingdom, because essentially they come in and Jesus is like, yeah, you know that lottery that you just hit? Leave it behind.
You never know. Like, you never know what happens to it. Like, is it just Jewish rhetoric? Do they actually sell it and then go? But the language is distinctly, yeah. And that moment, they left everything and they followed him. Like, did they leave the fish for the guys? Did they leave them for their families? We don't know. But Jesus has this source of perpetual wealth. And I think that's just the language that I loved. Like, Peter actually sees a religious leader that has chosen God over mammon. Because lots of them talk a good game, but we see all through the Gospels Pharisees that are distinctly interested in money, Sadducees that are distinctly interested in money. It's a rarity that you see a religious leader who's just like, yeah, don't care for it, don't need it. Most of them have become richer because of their faith or their religious position than they would have without it.
Yeah.
And so now Peter's found this guy who's just like, yeah, I don't need it.
So
that felt like this story centered in scripture that could kind of catapult us to the question of like, well, how do you do that then? Like, how do you, what is the mechanism by which you might be able to leave behind whatever perpetual wealth seems on offer? And we've got people in the church that have done that.
Yeah.
Like, there's some great stories in our community of people who've just had it staring them in the face and said, yeah, don't need it.
Yeah.
I have enough. So what's the language then was the question, which really, to me, led us to that last part.
Yeah. So this, you're essentially arguing, and I agree with you, that this is sort of the big thesis. You know, there's multiple movements, obviously, in chapter 6, but this is kind of maybe a great summary statement. If there was a big idea for the whole chapter, that seeking the kingdom first, like getting that priority in place, mm-hmm. is what you should be focused on. And then all of the rest of your needs will be met then by that priority, by that kingdom, is the theory that Jesus is laying out. Yeah,
and it's maybe, I do think it's interesting in life, like, and I did unpack this just for a little bit. When you try not to do something, it's not usually a helpful practice. Like saying, I'm not going to worry, seems to like potentially create more worry. And Amy Jill, oh, what's her name? I'm blanking on it. She's a New Testament professor. She wrote a great book on the Sermon on the Mount. And
Amy Jill.
I think it's Amy Jill or somebody.
Amy Jill, Sally, Lisa. It's one of those, you know, girl names.
No, it's a double barrel name. I'm going to pull it up right now. It is going to be super like irritating. Yeah, it's like a hyphenated name.
Okay. Amy Jill.
Amy Jill. Amy Jill Levine. She's a New Testament.
Double hyphen almost.
She's a New Testament.
Not Avril Lavigne.
Avril Lavigne. Okay. She did not write any books on the Sermon on the Mount that I'm aware of. Yeah. Some great songs in the 90s, if you're into that kind of thing. She's a New Testament professor who's actually Jewish.
Nice.
So she's a bit fascinating, really, as a person to read. And now I can't remember why I'm quoting her. Oh, yeah, she talks about how she sees that in her students. Like, when they study this passage, she'll see them start to worry about the amount that they're worrying. Well, I'm worrying about the exam I've got to take. Is that wrong? Like, I'm worrying I won't get enough good. And so, like, it's almost like in trying not to do it, they become more likely to do it. And you see this with all sorts of different avenues. That's another reason why I didn't want to over focus on the do not worry passages.
Interesting.
So I used to work, we started working when I was a youth pastor with a group out in Barcelona, and it was a drug rehab. And one of their strategies for helping them stay clean was to just have them work tons of hours to create minimal space where they were just sat around with nothing to do, because that's where they tend to see them go back
to
drugs.
What's that saying, idle hands?
Yeah, the devil, maybe, the devil's something or not.
Yeah, or the devil's playground or something like that. Yeah.
So it seems like do not worry is best accomplished. Being obedient to the command to do not worry is best accomplished by seeking first the kingdom.
Yeah. That's
and, powerful. And leaving behind wealth, the passage before, again, best accomplished by seeking the kingdom. Jesus doesn't say to Peter, give up the money and do nothing. He doesn't say, give away the fish and just sit on the beach.
He almost doesn't even reference the fish. He just says, follow me.
Yeah. He leads them into a preferred future.
Interesting.
That allows them to leave behind the past.
Yeah, there you go. There's a powerful spiritual practice to, like, and I think that that's true. A lot of the times, if you're obsessing about trying to eliminate a sin in your life or a habit or a whatever, maybe filling that space with something positive is actually a better strategy than obsessing about that.
A guy
thing
that
itself.
Used to come preach at our church when I was little, he used to reference this story, and I've always wanted to know, like, I've kind of wanted to know if it's real, but also it's too good a story to really do much investigative work. But he used to tell this story about a friend of his who was a zoologist who asked him to come look at a snake that they had at the zoo. And whether it's hypnosis, it's probably not. It's probably just something else. But they were feeding the snake, and the snake just lay in the corner, and they put a bird alive into the snake's terrarium. And the snake didn't move. It just fixed its eyes on this bird and just stayed deadly still. And the bird can easily stay away from the snake. There's no problem. But after a while, the snake kind of like hopped down off it, the little branch it was on, and hopped down onto the ground, just started pecking around, and slowly it like hopped closer and closer to the snake until it got to a point where it was right next to it. And the snake just gobbled it up. And he used it as this metaphor for what happens when your way of avoiding sin is to try really hard to avoid doing it and put all your energy into that. And by extension, when your strategy to avoid worry is to not worry, when your strategy to avoid being addicted to wealth is to think loads about being addicted to wealth, it actually doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so it seems like if you can take, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness and the beauty in that and the glory it brings to your Father when you live that way, you're far more able to live the life Jesus calls you to live than you are when you try really hard not to do bad things.
Which is actually, I mean, maybe to redeem the illustrations Jesus uses. Which is actually, I think, the actual emphasis that he wants to place on those two illustrations is less about the psychological state of flowers and birds.
Yeah.
It's actually about the abundance of the kingdom of God.
Yes. Yeah.
That it's the emphasis of those two illustrations of birds finding food. Like, they wake up, they don't clock into anything. Mm-hmm. There's just food laying on the ground. Everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All around them, they have this plethora of options for them to eat. And then flowers, they don't do anything. They just take root and water shows up for them occasionally and nutrients comes in through this. They don't do anything because the earth and God's world and his created order, his kingdom, are all obeying the systems and structures of how it's supposed to work and function.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, we have a friend, we both have maybe a little bit more of acquaintance for you, I don't know, but One of my friends in my small group is like a super big Green Thumb.
Yeah, yeah.
And he loves plants and all of this stuff. And he does all this research on, like, if you just let the world sort of function the way it's supposed to function and without as much greed and, you know, that a lot of farming is like destroyed the atmosphere and destroyed the soil and all the stuff. There's just a plethora of energy and life and all this stuff to be had.
Yeah.
And that's enough to provide for all of the needs, which is exactly what this is saying too. It's saying you seek first the kingdom and you enjoy his world, his kingdom, his way of thinking. You focus your attention on the king and his goodness and the beauty that he's created the world. All of that is your attention is there. And then you're like, oh, should I worry about stuff? Why would I worry? Like, I'm like, there's just this world that's just teeming with life and goodness and beauty.
And it tends to be when human beings obsess over gaining more and obsess over the future that they tend to break some natural rules.
Yeah.
So like, even
the,
like,
world's a hot mess because of greed.
Yeah. Well, you think about things like crop rotations and stuff and giving fields fallow years. Well, we break that rule because we want crops from our fields every single year. Whereas children of Israel knew, lots of people have known over history, no, actually fields need time to recover too. You can't grow the same thing in every year and continue to produce healthy crops and good results.
Exactly.
We've started working on the seventh day because we believe that we can grow the business a little bit better.
Yeah,
if
I'm
we
like
break that rule. If
one seventh better than the business next door that's closed.
Yeah. So it's like, it's become like a, someone said to me years ago, and it's always stuck with me, that really at its heart, America as a nation has two gods, sex and reaching your potential. And so the implication of reaching your potential is you break all the rules and you set no boundaries to practice the extra day and to work towards the business the extra day. And to grow the extra year of crop.
Yeah.
Because, well, you've never really reached your potential if you don't.
So I love, like, there's this theologian named Walter Brueggemann.
Oh, Walter.
Interesting dude. He's kind of funny, but he's a Old Testament scholar, but he does a lot of deep work on Sabbath.
Yeah.
And one of the most beautiful images I've heard of what Sabbath is meant to be is like, I don't know if he used this term exactly or if I'm translating it from his writings, but it's like flipping the bird to the system.
Yeah, totally.
So taking Sabbath is like, I'm not playing this whole keep up with the Joneses game.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's like practicing Sabbath is like this, is it's a violent attack on the systems of the world that says, I have to make more. I have to gather in.
Uh-huh.
I have to like accumulate more. And then the follower of Jesus says once a week, they're like, by the way, just so my own soul knows and everyone else knows, I don't play that game.
Well,
because I'm like the bird.
And the heartbreaking thing is the church ruined Sabbath, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
maybe just for pastors.
But I think, like, so you go back and you read what the Jewish Sabbath looked like.
Yeah.
There's no, like, church attendance. There's no, like, there's no things you have to do. It's rest. It's like time with family. It's as you say, opting out of the need to make everything the best it can possibly be. It's don't work on the house today. It's like I mean, it's like,
yeah,
it's so beautiful when you think about it. And we turned it into dress up in the most uncomfortable clothes you can find, go to church multiple times, even when you're seven and that's boring as you like sit there and don't have fun afterwards while we enjoy a meal together. Like it just, the implication for a whole generation of people, probably before our generation, was be miserable on the Sabbath. That will make God happy. And worship was included in the Sabbath, but in this beautifully informal family way. It wasn't going to a church building.
Yeah.
So we kind of killed the thing with Sabbath. Like, no, but most people have no clue how good it is.
Yeah, which is why, like, I've said this a dozen times, maybe even on the show, which is why disc golf feels like the actual Sabbath for me.
Yeah.
Because it's the least productive thing I do. Uh-huh. I'm that awesome at disc golf. I'm literally accomplishing nothing.
Yeah.
I'm usually not making shots. Yeah. I'm usually not improving my score. It's actually getting worse and worse every year.
Yeah.
So I'm not winning any awards. Uh-huh. The world is spinning without me. I'm out there wasting time being in creation, and it feels deeply Sabbath
uh-huh.
because of all of those things. It's like flipping the bird
yeah.
to the system.
Yeah.
Sticking it to the man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it, so we miss all of that element of it. We've forgotten just how beautiful it is to not achieve things. Wayne Mueller has this beautiful book on Sabbath, and he pulls traditions from all over the place, but it's primarily Jewish and Christian. And like, he just invites you in these beautiful ways to Sabbath. He'll say things like, you know, when you get home, light a candle alone or with friends, enjoy a meal together. Whatever didn't get done today will not get done now. Like, just let it go. Like, trust that, like, in line with it, with this, that trust that the God of the universe will provide. And then what he actually says as a push point to it is, he said, when you don't take Sabbath seriously, car accidents become your Sabbath. Sickness becomes your Sabbath. Like, somewhere, God has a way of bringing you to rest. And I found that in that season, yeah. my gallbladder blew up, and I had that. I just lay in that hospital bed, and I was like, nobody expects me to do anything right now. And this is amazing. I had forgotten what it felt like to not always be on.
And needed, yeah.
And needed.
Another reason why a good silent retreat is helpful, especially if it's like a guide or a retreat like at Sacred Heart, yeah. where your food is provided. You're like, I don't even need to prepare my own meals.
Yeah, I am napping, and I am doing exactly what God wants me to be doing.
Yeah, right now. My existence means nothing right now.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
which is sounds like maybe sort of morbid, uh-huh. but it's also such a gift. As a human being, you aren't designed to carry the weight of the world on your shoulders. And every single day, all of us are running around pretending like we can.
Yeah.
And then if you tap out of that system for a little bit and you're like, I'm just meant to exist in God's world and feast upon his mm-hmm. goodness, mm-hmm. like the birds and like the flowers, you're like, what a gift. This is actually what my soul was made for, was to just partake in the God's goodness.
And I think pastors are incredibly awful at this one, because like Sunday can't be a Sabbath to us in the way that we do church. So
yeah.
It's by nature going to feel like not a day of rest. And so there has to be a different day. When we do silent retreats, the temptation is to take books that will be useful for sermon series or to read passages of scripture that we plan to teach on. So actually opting out of all of those things, sometimes like times where I've been to Sacred Heart, I'll just take a book that actually just seems fun for no other reason than I like to read it. It's usually got some spiritual element to it, but it's usually just designed to opt out of thinking about writing a sermon.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually just this beautiful gift.
All right. So we have just a few minutes left. I have one question. Mm-hmm. More, because we didn't get any other questions that came in for this week, but this passage, this seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Mm-hmm. Is that a promise? Does that actually work? All the things, as in food, housing, shelters. Yeah. Yeah. If I don't have everything that I feel like I need, am I not seeking the kingdom enough?
So as I said before, my conviction is that Jesus' overall message in this is that if you don't get it in this life, there is a future promise of it. I think if that's what he means, then I have a bunch of questions that go unanswered, which is fine. I'm used to having questions go unanswered.
You can't be a pastor. That's another tip. You want to be a pastor, get comfortable with unanswered questions sometimes.
So I think I think I My struggle with it, I think, is an existential one, but also an anecdotal one. It's like, well, what does that mean for my friends in Haiti right now? Who the country's blowing up? They have no resources. The island's been decimated. There is no food for people. Like that thing is going to get worse and worse and worse. Outside some miraculous thing, people are dying. People are hungry. It seems like God isn't providing. Kids are walking around with no clothes on. Like, so what does that mean for them? Because some of them are very godly people. Some of them deeply love Jesus. And I've watched some of them sing songs of, that say over and over again, Master Jesus, in the midst of earthquakes, in the midst of like nothing. And they've said it with tears running down their faces. And so I think that's my question with it. Like, if it's just as simple as, if you're someone who prioritizes the kingdom, you'll have enough to eat. I have so many people that I know that haven't had enough to eat.
Yeah, but I think if you couple it with this last verse in the chapter, which maybe you can't even see because I've like, let me scoot this over. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Like, Jesus isn't naive. Mm-hmm. He's not saying there's no trouble.
Yeah.
He's just saying, like, okay, how often do we, like, worry our answers out of existence?
Yeah.
So let's just live in the moment and pursue the kingdom and then, like, reap the harvest of that in our souls.
Yeah, I think one of the things that gets forgotten with this passage is Jesus isn't saying don't work hard.
Yeah.
Like, his language is about the worry of tomorrow, not when you don't have enough to eat today, don't do what you need to do to get resources.
Yeah. And like, even like our conversation about Sabbath, you have to be intentional in order to enjoy Sabbath.
Yeah.
You have to do some prep work. Like, if you're the type of person that can't rest in a messy house, then maybe the night before you do some meal prep planning. You might tidy up a little bit so that you can like think a little bit. So it might take a little bit extra planning in order to truly enter into the rest. So yeah, still work.
Yeah. And they worked 6 days. We tend to work five unless we work all the time. So I think there's a whole bunch of elements going on there. I think you have to couple these couple of passages with the idea that we're told you don't have today promised you on this life. Like, we tend to assume tomorrow is guaranteed. And Jesus actually is really explicit on that. You know, there's this famous story of the guy who's like, oh, I've got it all set aside for decades to come. There's always going to be enough to eat.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, but tonight your soul will be demanded of you. So I think that all of those things play into my reading of this. I think there's an element to which it has a direct application to his disciples. It's not that it doesn't matter to us, but he's leading a group into this moment where they're about to be sent out. And they will see that kind of provision. They will go with no food and no drink or extra clothing, and it'll be provided.
Yeah.
But I think, I think your point is accurate. It's not just naivety. It recognizes that there's trouble.
Yeah, and the text even says, your father knows you need these things. It's not like he's ignorant.
Yeah. But,
it messes with us because it's definitely counterintuitive to a lot of what culture and society and the world says we provide for these needs.
My upbringing, you grew up in Africa. Like, my first memories of church were around us trying to provide food for the Romanian famine, where there's, just thousands of people starving to death. To just say, oh, yeah, those must all be ungodly people who aren't seeking first the kingdom of God feels off to me. I just don't. So I feel like there's more for me to learn in this passage.
Yeah.
Which I like.
Yeah. Anything else you wanted to share?
No. It's Holy Week.
It's Holy Week. We're hanging out with Peter this week. Sunday, and then, like, spoiler alert, Good Friday, we're going to hang out with Peter a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we might even talk a little bit about Peter on Easter. We're not saying anything else.
I just was rereading my favorite, like, one of my favorite fun moments in Scripture. And I've referenced it multiple Easters. It wouldn't surprise me if I just referenced it again, because it always just makes me laugh every time I read it. It's the bit where in John's Gospel, they run to the tomb, and John's like, oh, by the way, I got there first. Like, it's so schoolboyish, but yes. It's just like...
Yeah, it definitely makes you wonder, like, Peter and John's relationship, either they're like bickering brothers... Or they genuinely don't like each other. Like, it's got to be one of those two, because they're constantly, so there's intrigued. Little subtle jabs all over the place.
For all eternity. I mean, he's writing it like in church history theory, at least he's writing it like 60 years later. And one of the big takeaways he remembers was winning a foot race.
Yeah.
He may have gone on to lead the church, but I won the race.
I want to think, this is my theory about it, I want to believe that they just did that all the time. They were always like picking on each other, and that John literally just leaves Easter eggs in his gospel just for Peter.
Who's probably dead at that point, though.
To probably just just jab him, you know?
Peter's probably been dead for 20 years. Oh, it's, man. Still like...
Still want to believe it.
If you think Peter's slow now, he was slow when he was alive. It's just so weird.
And John's the sweet kind.
I know, yeah. I'm just every time I read it, I actually just laugh out loud to myself.
Yeah. All right. On that note, we're gonna wrap it up. And I don't know how to end. Oh yeah, I have to push a button here. I keep forgetting.
Happy Holy Week. See you on Friday and Sunday.
Yeah, bye.